Hitler's War by David Irving. Chapter is called Retreat. Hitler saw in the new year, 1943, sitting alone in his bunker with Martin Bormann, his party secretary, until after 4 a.m. This itself presaged the coming times. In the year that followed, a significant part of Hitler's domestic authority was delegated to a three-man cabal, Bormann, Keitel, and Lammers, convening in what had been the cabinet room of the Berlin Chancellery, while Goebbels hovered like a predator calling impatiently for the quote-unquote Führer of the home front to descend upon him. Hitler was rarely in Berlin. He dedicated himself to his war, sustained by the prospect of coming offensives, of the growing U-boat campaign, and of increased panzer and aircraft production, and by evidence that Stalin's reserves were at last declining. At night he could not sleep, for before his eyes there danced the arrow-covered maps of the evening's war conference, until at last the sedatives dragged him down into unconsciousness. For the next 6 months he proved more accessible to the advice of the general staff. The retreats that marked these months were considerable military achievements. Only at Stalingrad and in the first disordered retreat to the Donets did the army lose equipment of any consequence. Thereafter, the withdrawals were planned and fought so as to inflict the maximum hardship and casualties on the enemy. Still sure of their superiority, the German soldiers felt that they were being overwhelmed by circumstance, not by the Russian army, by lack of oil, by inclement weather, by unreliable allies. Their trust in Hitler remained unshaken, but the security service reports indicated that at home the first mutterings of popular discontent were becoming audible. General Eberhard von Mackensen's 1st Panzer Army began its withdrawal from the Caucasus on January 1, 1943, and completed it 30 days later, having covered over 400 miles under appalling conditions. 18-horse teams struggled to haul the heavy guns through the mountains. Simultaneously, General Ruoff's 17th Army withdrew from the Western Caucasus. Thus, at a cost of 226 lives, an entire army group, some 700,000 men, was saved. Pretty good. Against Zietzler's advice, however, Hitler directed only 4 of Mackensen's divisions to Rostov. The rest were added to Ruoff's army, which was ordered during January to hold a bridgehead on the Taman Peninsula, just over the narrow straits from the Crimea. This would, argued Hitler, show friend and foe alike that in 1943 he again intended to go over to the offensive. With Albert Speer, he even adumbrated plans to build across the Strait of Kerch a giant bridge linking the Crimea to the quote-unquote Goth's Head, as the Taman Bridge was termed. Meanwhile, in the dying days of the old year, Hitler had conceived a grand operational design. He would speedily transfer the 3 most powerful SS divisions and the quote-unquote Grossdeutschland infantry division from Army Group Center, assemble them southeast of Kharkov, and strike north of the Don toward Stalingrad as soon as the weather improved. That would be mid-February. Paulus's spirits were raised by Hitler's convincing assurances. Hitler promised that the Luftwaffe would carry 750 tons of supplies in on the days when the weather was good. Goering did his best. Already 480 Junkers and Heinkels were committed solely to the airlift. Still more planes were sent. 100 more Junkers, 10 Focke-Wulf Condors, and several Heinkel 177 bombers, too. A visit by a responsible Luftwaffe commander would have been more fruitful, but Jeschenik could not spare the time, and Goering averted his gaze from the seemingly inevitable disaster. Despite his Stalingrad worries, Hitler telephoned Frau Troost in person from East Prussia to congratulate her on the solid gold cassette she had designed for Goering's warrant as Reichsmarshal, correctly speculating that this female arbiter legendarium would noise his evident well-being abroad. But his misgivings, in fact, were multiplying. Colonel von Bello, his Luftwaffe adjutant, showed him a private letter from a relative trapped in Stalingrad, and its references to the 6th Army's commanders were not encouraging. A question mark was placed against Paulus's name. General Arthur Schmidt and General Walter von Seydlitz were marked, quote-unquote, sack 'em, but General Huber was praised, he's the man. The year had opened with an exasperating series of errors over an Allied convoy to North Russia. According to naval intelligence, it was escorted only by destroyers. Raeder's liaison officer, Admiral Theodor Kranke, had asked Hitler for his blessing for a sortie by Hipper, Lützow, and six destroyers to attack the convoy off Bear Island. The pocket battleship Lützow would afterward break out into the Atlantic, Operation Aurora. Throughout New Year's Eve, the Führer was left in virtual ignorance of the progress of the battle. Under his impatient pressure, Kranke somewhat tactlessly showed him the only two radio messages bearing on the battle's outcome. Admiral Kumitz had merely radioed, quote, break off the attack. No enemy cruiser with convoy. Not possible to detach Lützow for Aurora. But the end quote. But the shadowing U-boat had radioed as the Arctic dusk engulfed the scene, quote, I see just red, end quote. Hitler interpreted the above messages optimistically. He bragged to Ribbentrop that the Navy had just won a magnificent victory. But not until noon next afternoon did he learn the woeful truth. British cruisers had been lurking nearby. His own task force had run for cover. The cruiser Hipper was badly damaged. A German destroyer had mistakenly joined the enemy and paid dearly for her error. Hitler raged at the Navy's lack of aggressive spirit. He announced that he was going to lay up all the big ships, and he ordered Kranke to instruct Raeder by telephone to come to the Wolf's Lair at once. Raeder's stock with Hitler was already low. He had been a less frequent visitor to the Führer than his critics. Out of jealousy, Goering had furnished Hitler with a string of complaints about the admiral. Speer had done the same, angered by Raeder's refusal to abrogate control over naval armament to the munitions ministry. As recently as January 4th, Speer had reported the Navy to Hitler for hoarding six oil-paper-wrapped 105mm anti-aircraft guns in the depot. In fact, they were there for ranging and calibration tests. The admiral arrived late on January 6th. Hitler berated him for 90 minutes on the ship's failure ever since 1864 to fight a single naval action right through. Neither its mutiny in 1918 nor its scuttling in 1919 were exactly glorious episodes. He wanted the ships laid up and their armament built into the coastal defenses. Raeder tendered his resignation. Asked to submit the names of two possible successors, Raeder suggested Admiral Rolf Karls or, alternatively, though with marked distaste, Dönitz. On January 14th, Raeder submitted a written protest predicting, quote-unquote, shrieks of triumph from the enemy when they learned that the Germans had mothballed their own biggest warships. Hitler heaped sarcasm on the document, but Kranke could see that he was impressed nonetheless. As Hitler told Marshal Antonescu on January 10th, neither in the Punic Wars, nor in the 30 Years' War, nor in the 7 Years' War, had any of the statesmen been able to predict how it would all end, yet their single-minded purpose had brought them to victory. This was whistling in the dark. On the 12th, the Russians waded into the Hungarian Second Army, striking towards Svoboda, just as Hitler had predicted. The Hungarians suffered 30,000 dead within days. Hitler's tactical measures rushing anti-tank guns to the Hungarians and calling in three more divisions from France, came too late. On the entire Eastern Front, he learned he now had less than 500 tanks. The Russians had 5,000. With the help of Goebbels and Bormann, he planned to wring a million troops out of the German population by mid-1943. In December, he had ordered German industry to release 200,000 men for call-up by the end of March. The demand was stepped up to 800,000 men. Twice in January, Hitler called Speer to the Wolf's Lair and told him he wanted bigger, better, and more tanks. On the 17th, he decided to launch a new production program, the Adolf Hitler Tank Program. He buttonholed Admiral Kranke after the war conference and told him unemotionally that all warship construction larger than destroyers was to cease forthwith so that Speer could have the manpower he needed for tanks. Quote, Even if it is only 5,000 men, it will help, unquote, Hitler noted. When Kronke protested, Hitler again harked back to the inconsequential naval action off Bear Island. Quote, the tanks that convoy brought through have now probably cost more soldiers than their lives south of Lake Ladoga, end quote, he said. Kronke reminded Hitler of his standing orders against risking the big ships against any superior enemy, but Hitler referred to the Graf Spee and Bismarck episodes as proof that it was the spirit that was wanting. Not long afterward, Admiral Dönitz stood before Hitler, eagerly conniving at the consignment of the big ships to the wreckers yard. Raeder retired into obscurity. Before he left, he begged Hitler to protect the Navy from Goering, and he warned his successor not to put his trust in Speer. At 50, Goering's star was in rapid decline. In mid-January, Hitler sent for Goering's deputy Milch and put him in charge of the struggling airlift to Stalingrad, a step which the jealous Goering had urgently counseled against. Along the southern front, as far north as Voronezh, an avalanche of Soviet troops and tanks was pouring through the breach created by the Romanian, Italian, and Hungarian collapse. Hitler's object was to keep Paulus's army fighting for 6 more weeks at least, until it could be relieved by Paul Hauser's SS Panzer Corps. But General von Weichs cabled that his army group was left with barely 7 divisions along a 200-mile front. He saw no possible way of holding the enemy. At any moment, the Russians might encircle the Second Army. From within Stalingrad, strong protests were now emanating from the Sixth Army. 2. Quote, Mein Führer, Paulus radioed on the 17th, your orders on the supply of my army are not being obeyed, end quote. The Luftwaffe generals denied Paulus's allegations. Goering later bitterly accused Paulus of being too soft a commander, of feeding thousands of Russian civilians and useless German soldiers, injured German soldiers. Quote, one can't burden oneself with wounded men beyond hope of recovery, he said. They must be left to lapse into the hereafter, end quote. General Huba, again flown out of Stalingrad to the Wolf's Lair, feelingly reproached Hitler. Quote, the Luftwaffe airlift has failed. Why don't you kill off some of your Luftwaffe generals? End quote. Hitler replied in level terms. Quote, I've got it all in hand. End quote. He assigned Huba to Milch's emergency staff, but turned a deaf ear on his advice to appoint a commander-in-chief East, suspecting that the advice had come from Manstein. Richthofen painted a vivid portrait of Manstein in this month of crisis. Quote, in my view, Manstein is a write-off, trembling in every limb and looking years older, end quote. Disaster seemed inevitable. At Hitler's headquarters, Zietzler pointedly introduced Stalingrad rations for his staff. On January 22nd, the Russians again called on Paulus to surrender. Hitler remarked that Russians would abide by no conventions. No prisoners would survive long. On the other hand, every day the Sixth Army fought on would help destabilize the other fronts. Paulus radioed a dignified, even fatalistic response to Hitler's instructions. Quote, your orders are being executed. Long live Germany. End quote. Hitler calculated that the word of his soldiers' heroism at Stalingrad would itself be worth many divisions in the months to come. The legend of Stalingrad would enhance each later fortress's invincibility in enemy eyes. To this end, Goebbels instructed that brutal frankness now be observed in describing the situation of German soldiers in Stalingrad. Above all, the Bolshevik victory communiqué were to pass unchallenged, the better to bring a shiver of apprehension to the peoples of the West. On January 24th, German newspapers for the first time revealed the death throes of the Sixth Army. 29,000 injured troops had been evacuated by the time Paulus's last airfield was overrun. His remaining soldiers had been allowed to write one last letter home. When the last Heinkel took off, it brought out 19 injured soldiers and 7 bags of mail. In Stalingrad, Paulus's army had been severed into 2 pockets, but his men fought on. The Luftwaffe crews flew 2 and sometimes even 3 sorties a night to discharge food and ammunition over Stalingrad. Quote, on the anniversary of your assumption of power, Paulus radioed Hitler, the Sixth Army sends its greetings to the Führer. The swastika still flutters over Stalingrad. May our struggle stand as an example to generations yet as yet unborn, never to surrender, no matter how desperate the odds. Then Germany will be victorious. Heil mein Führer. End quote. Hitler's reply was a proclamation broadcast to the German nation. It ended, quote, "In this fight we shall have the Almighty on our side. We shall not shy from shedding our own blood, because one day a new land will blossom from the sacrifices of the fallen, and our Teutonic state, our German nation, shall emerge victorious." End quote. At Zeitzler's insistence, though not without misgivings, Hitler promoted Paulus to field marshal. Since no German field marshal had yet surrendered, he thus pressed the pistol into the unfortunate army commander's hand. At 7:35 a.m., on the 31st, 6th Army headquarters radioed, quote, "In our bunker we listened to the Führer's proclamation and saluted the national anthem for perhaps the last time," end quote. Almost at once they added, quote, "The Russians are outside the door," and then, "We are destroying... dot, dot, dot," end quote. The radio went dead. Hitler probably spared little attention for Stalingrad that day, for alarm bells were ringing throughout his dominions. In North Africa, Rommel was retreating toward Tunisia. Tripoli, and thus Libya itself, had been abandoned by the Axis. In northwest Germany, American heavy bombers had just attacked Wilhelmshaven in broad daylight. And on January 30th, on January 30th, fast British bombers had penetrated to Berlin at noon. Quote, "An impertinence! It's called the Mosquito, and it's made of wood!" End quote. The Luftwaffe's own heavy bomber, the Heinkel 177, was still not perfected. 19 sorties had been flown to Stalingrad, 6 had been ended by engine fires in mid-air. Now Germany was compelled to retreat along the entire Eastern Front. Kharkov itself was in danger. In the Demansk pocket south of Leningrad, so jealously defended by Hitler these many months, supplies were running low. It would have to be given up at last. There seemed to be concrete evidence that the Allies would soon invade Portugal, thus divisions were tied down in the west. Hitler had turned in at 2:30 a.m., earlier than usual, that first day of February. He was shortly wakened with word from Moscow. Defying tradition, Paulus had surrendered, as had 11 German and 5 Romanian generals. Hitler was thunderstruck. He could never forgive his field marshal that he had lacked the routine courage of every captain who had gone down with his ship, that he had not mustered the same bravery as had the score of Soviet commissars and commanders in identically hopeless situations. Quote, "The others stick together, form a phalanx, and keep the last bullet for themselves. Imagine, even a woman with an ounce of pride in her will lock herself in and put a bullet in her brain just because she has heard a few insulting words." End quote. No, not end quote. There's an asterisk. That's what's interrupting this quote. Let's go down and see it. Was this perhaps a revealing allusion to the 1931 suicide of Gailey Rabel? Right, because Gailey killed herself. Continuing the quote, "Here is a man who can look on while 50,000 or 60,000 of his troops are dying and defending themselves with courage to the end. How can he give himself up to the Bolsheviks?" End quote. When Speer's deputy Karl Saar telephoned the Führer at 3 a.m. with the January production figures, for the first time Hitler did not want to hear them. Throughout February, appalling crises gripped the Eastern Front. Weichs was removed. His army group had virtually dissolved. Through the yawning gaps thundered the Soviet herd. Quote, "I won't be able to sleep again without sedatives until the breach is plugged," declared Hitler. Only his staff stenographers shared his awful, all-embracing knowledge of the true picture. The diary of one of them reveals that a stenographer who had arrived as recently as December had suffered a nervous breakdown by mid-February, frightened of fresh bloody nightmares. Oh, no. February. End his sentence. Frightened of fresh bloody nightmares, Hitler postponed retiring longer every night. He explained to an army doctor 2 years later, quote, "I have to relax and speak about something else. Otherwise, I keep seeing the staff maps in the dark, and my brain goes grinding on, and it takes me hours on end to drop off." End quote. In 2 months, the Red Army had demolished five armies, German, Romanian, Italian, and Hungarian. By the end of February, the Russians had recaptured Kursk, Belgorod, Krasnodar, Demyansk, Rostov, and Kharkov. Hitler might even have to abandon the Donets Basin. Quote, "I shall have to think it over," he declared on February 1st, referring to the latter prospect. "But one thing I can say now, if I do abandon the Donets, there will be no further possibility of bringing the war in the East to an offensive conclusion. Let's make no mistake about that." End quote. Hitler still would not contemplate a political settlement with Stalin. Japan's Ambassador Oshima had called on January 20th and left disappointed in this respect. Indeed, Hitler urgently demanded a Japanese attack on Stalin in the Far East. When Huell brought to him Ribbentrop's renewed proposal for peace feelers toward Moscow, Hitler refused even to read it. Quote, "First we must win a major military victory," end quote, he told Ribbentrop afterward. "Then we can see it," quote unquote. It was a familiar, circuitous argument. In presenting his plans to mobilize the native populations of the East against Stalin, Rosenberg fared no better than Ribbentrop. By early 1943, the Germans had over 130,000 quote-unquote Eastern troops, and there were Russian generals willing to lead them against Stalin. But Hitler suspected that it would be playing with dynamite, that it would merely be a rekindling of Russian nationalism under a different management. When in February 1943 Rosenberg read him a lengthy proposal for replacing the Soviet collective system with private enterprise and property again, raising legions from the Soviet Union's ethnic groups, restoring their freedom of religion, and issuing a suitable political proclamation to them, Hitler responded merely that he might return to some of the proposals, quote, "after the coming spring offensive began," end quote. Zietzler mentioned to him that the captured Russian general Andrei Andreevich Vlasov was willing to lead a, quote-unquote, "national army of liberation" against Stalin, but Hitler saw in the general only a useful propaganda tool. Quote, "What a swine Vlasov must be," he commented to his own staff. "He owes everything to Stalin. It was Stalin who made a general out of him. Now he bites the hand that fed him." End quote. Not that he expected Paulus to act any differently. Quote, "A few weeks in, the Lubyanka prison, and he will say anything," predicted Hitler. "Just wait and see. It won't be long before he's speaking on Moscow radio." End quote. The cost of Stalingrad had been high. Goering's Luftwaffe had lost 488 aircraft and about 1,000 airmen in the airlift. Only 108,000 of Paulus's troops had survived to enter Soviet captivity, of which only 6,000 were ever to see Germany again. On February 4th, however, Galen's intelligence division estimated that 107 Soviet divisions and brigades had been tied down by the battle for the city, together with 13 tank regiments. He could do little more than guess at where Stalin's next offensive would begin. Hitler was still optimistic that shortages of food and raw materials would defeat Stalin. His agencies had captured a Russian document listing their casualties by now as 11,200,000 dead, missing, and injured. It seemed well worth fighting on. He spent much of February 1943 mending the fences torn by these winter's storms. On Sunday the 7th, he invited the Gauleiters to his headquarters and briefed them on the disaster. Herbert Bock dictated this summary to his wife the next day. Quote, "Sunday at the Führer's, the Führer spoke. First words were, quote, what you are witnessing as a catastrophe of unheard is a catastrophe of unheard magnitude. The Russians broke through. The Romanians gave up. The Hungarians didn't even put up a fight. For 5 days, German troops from the rear held the front in a thin line thrown across the breakthrough locations. We've lost four armies in and around Stalingrad." End quote. Or unquote. Quote for the letter is still going. "Compares our situation with Collin and Kunersdorf. says that if Frederick had had weapons like ours, they'd never have called him the Great, because then his 7 years' war would have been over in 2 months. The Führer again praised Speer. The Führer also said, quote, if the German people fails, then it does not deserve that we fight for its future. Then we can write it off with equanimity, end unquote. Not the right attitude of mind, end quote. The Gauleiters were satisfied by Hitler's speech, but the damage to the general's confidence in him was less easily repaired. General Schmundt, who he had sent on a fact-finding tour of the army group Don just before Stalingrad fell, must have faithfully reported the ugly mood brewing there, that Manstein, Milch, and Richthofen were unanimous that so long as Hitler directed each battalion in person, the army would always lack the rapid, incisive direction from above that it needed for victory. In short, that Hitler would appoint a commander-in-chief east. They clearly favored Manstein, but though Hitler accepted him as their greatest military commander when on the offensive, in their present dilemma he felt they needed a tough, tenacious bulldog of a man, and with a flair for improvisation. So speaking about himself. Milch, who flew straight from the Stalingrad front with Huba on February 3rd, received a hostile hearing. Goering had just bragged to Hitler that 2,000 new aircraft had been manufactured in January. Hitler snapped at Milch. Quote, let's see if you can keep it up. He stressed the need for a cheap, primitive transport plane capable of making the round trip to Africa without refueling. He rebuked Milch so severely for the calamitous record of the Heinkel 177 bomber project that a few days later the field marshal gasped to his staff, quote, I stood in front of the Führer like a very small boy who has not done his sums properly, end quote. Manstein and Kluge summoned to the Wolf's Lair on the 6th fared no better. Hitler charmed the former with a frank admission that he alone was responsible for Stalingrad, not Goering. Quote, he is the man I have chosen as my successor, and that is why I cannot burden him with the blame for Stalingrad, end quote. After a four-hour display of obstinacy, he flattered Manstein by agreeing to his demand that the eastern Donetsk region should be abandoned to release the 4th Panzer Army for the coming German offensive on his army group's western flank. At long last, Hitler also bowed to Zeisler's recommendation that the uneconomical 300-mile-long salient around Rzhev and Vyazma should be abandoned in favor of the far shorter cord line in the rear. But Kluge had to promise to make the 21 divisions thus released available for a great spring offensive. The fighting retreat from Vyazma and Rzhev, codenamed Buffalo, began in March, the first German tactical triumph of 1943. These field marshals were still putty in Hitler's hands. The generals were more difficult. When General von Richthofen arrived at the Wolf's Lair with Goering on February 11th, he said bluntly that now they must get a grip on the ground organization of the army. Of course, they would be short of men as long as divisions that were 12,000 strong still put only 600 actual combat troops into the front line. Quote, the Führer asked me point-blank what I think of Manstein, end quote. Richthofen dictated into his diary, quote, I said that he is the best tactician and commander we have, but that Manstein, like all army commanders, is only really interested in operations and tactics. I stressed that the army commanders were all right, but must be given tactical freedom to act as their own local experience dictated. Leading them by the scruff of the neck as though they were children just did harm. The Führer said if he hadn't led them like that, they would have been fighting in Germany by now. Above all, I suggested that it was absolutely essential for him to have personal contact with them. If this particularly concerned him as Führer, he couldn't visit the armies for some reason or other I was not aware of, then they must be summoned at least once a month to talk over plans and possibilities with him. The Führer cursed his immediate advisers. He tells them everything, but they brief him falsely and do nothing. He took it calmly when I retorted that this wasn't of the slightest importance either to us at the front or to future historians. He alone was answerable. End quote. Hitler decided it was time Richthofen was made a field marshal too. When the Gauleiters had mustered at the Wolf's Lair, Hitler had congratulated Goebbels on his post-Stalingrad propaganda and unconditionally approved the propaganda minister's oft-stated demand for total war. It was what, quote-unquote, the people wanted. To Hitler, the opposition was an infinitesimal, misguided minority that had to be crushed. When a handful of Munich students scattered leaflets calling for Hitler's overthrow, the ringleaders were arrested and condemned to death by the People's Court. Quote, "Perhaps there are those who say it is incomprehensible that the People's Court acts so ruthlessly," Hitler thundered in a great speech to his generals later. "A man who just distributed leaflets, or another, a university professor and two students who distributed leaflets, are also executed. But if the professor and students responsible had been at the front, they might be just as dead now. Who knows? It's a risk every soldier takes all the time." End quote. At Zaporozhye in the Dnieper, the huge hydroelectric power station had just been rebuilt by AEG, the major German electric corporation, and electricity was again flowing to the coal mines and munitions plants of the surrounding Ukraine. Speer had recently shown Hitler the completion dates of his Project Ivan, the rapid expansion of the heavy chemical, nitrogen, and explosives industries of the Donetsk region. Hitler had anxiously ordered extra anti-aircraft batteries to protect the power station, but unless Manstein's sluggish counteroffensive in the Ukraine, gathered momentum, it was clear that the whole region would soon be overrun. To the consternation of Hitler's staff, Zietzler suggested that Hitler should fly out to Manstein's headquarters at Zaporozhye, it's a weird word, in person. When Goering indignantly objected to the risk, Zietzler sardonically pointed out, quote, "The Reichsmarshal will be able to darken the skies with his fighter squadrons. There's no risk," end quote. That night, Hitler's staff stenographer wrote in his diary, quote, "At this evening's conference, the Führer announced his decision to go to the front and take over command of Army Group South. This means breaking camp here," end quote. Hitler decided to take with him just Zietzler and Jodl, to whom he had finally extended his hand once again on January 30th, together with Schmundt, Huell, and his doctor Morell. Keitel, Bormann, and the other adjutants stayed behind at the Wolf's Lair. The long flight south began as soon as it was light on February 17, 1943. Quote, "By afternoon, the Führer's bunker was deserted," wrote a newly arrived private secretary Gertrude Trottel-Humps in a post-war manuscript. "It was strange, the hush that suddenly descended upon the whole compound. It was as if the main dynamo of the concern had stopped. This was the first time I sensed how much Hitler's personality acted as a mainspring for all these men. The puppet master who held all the marionettes, strings in his hands, had suddenly let them fall." End quote. No secret was made of Hitler's arrival at Manstein's headquarters. Quote, "There were cordons everywhere," Field Marshal von Richthofen wrote in his diary. "Everybody that I asked in the streets, where Army Group HQ was, smiled scornfully and said, 'You won't get near it. The Führer's there.' Found the Führer in the midst of a big war conference. I reported to him. Much beating around the bush. No real opinions. Mutual tension. An atmosphere you could cut a knife with. Or cut with a knife. Führer then withdrew to his headquarters without reaching any decisions. Führer, very pleasant to me. Placid, clear-thinking. The question is, has he the necessary implements and ability to convert his clear thoughts into orders?" End quote. The next evening, February 18th, German radio broadcast throughout occupied Europe Goebbels' defiant sports palace speech, whipping a vast audience of Berliners into a frenzy with his proclamation of total war. And there's an asterisk. See this author's analysis of the total war speech in Goebbels' Mastermind of the Third Reich. I'll get to it, don't worry. Back up. Next morning, Hitler himself addressed this effective proclamation to the troops on the eve of their counteroffensive between Dnieper and Donetsk rivers. Quote, "Soldier of Army Group South, Airman of the 4th Air Force, the outcome of a crucial battle depends on you. 1,000 kilometers away from the Reich's frontiers, the fate of Germany's present and fate of Germany's present and future is in the balance. The entire German homeland has been mobilized. Everybody down to the last man and woman is being called to serve your battle's needs. Our youth are manning the anti-aircraft defenses around Germany's cities and workplaces. More and more divisions are on their way. Weapons unique and hitherto unknown are on the way to your front. This is why I have flown to you, to exhaust every means of alleviating your defensive battle and to convert it into ultimate victory. If every one of you will help, we shall once again succeed with the Almighty's aid. End quote. By this time, Russian tanks were approaching. There was nothing between them and Zaporozhye. Hitler valued his person too highly to stay too long. He mentioned that he had ordered General Guderian to meet him soon at Vinnytsia. He had given in to Schmutz's badgering and decided to take the truculent general his inspector. He decided to make the truculent general his inspector of panzer troops. Richthofen recommended that Hitler immediately fly out for a couple of days and return to Zaporozhye if the Russian threat was thwarted. It was a diplomatic solution. With the gunfire of Russian tanks already audible from the airfield, Hitler took off for the Vinnytsia headquarters, Werwolf, immediately. Under Field Marshal von Manstein's able command, the 1st and 4th Panzer Armies struck northward on February 22nd. They soon threw a bridgehead across the Donets at Balaklaya. A new battle for Kharkov was about to begin. The Führer's confidence in Manstein was restored. At last, the Eastern Front was stabilized. Now Hitler could turn his attention to other affairs of state. On the last day of February 1943, General Jodl announced at Hitler's war conference that, during the night, a small British commando unit had mounted a rather odd operation against the hydroelectric power station at Rjukan, in Norway. The British saboteurs had appeared from nowhere, blown up the heavy water plant in the basement, and vanished into the surrounding terrain. Always over-apprehensive where Norway was concerned, Hitler took this operation as more than a personal affront. Both Speer and the scientists of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute had advised that atomic explosives could not be manufactured without heavy water. Hitler ordered the plant rebuilt immediately. A few days later, however, he learned that it would take at least 2 years to restore heavy water production. By that time, reflected Hitler grimly, the war would be long over. And that, I believe, is the end of that chapter.